60 students in the U.S. And also in Canada, and we're working to study and characterize the low-frequency gravitational wave universe using pulsar timing. And this is part of our worldwide effort, much like Gabby described with LIGO and ground-based instruments. This is a worldwide effort. We have European and Australian partners. Our relationship with them is a little bit different. We do have the International Pulsar Timing Array, but we have a kind of a cooperative and competitive relationship. So we'll first take our data using our telescopes, analyze it, and then once each collaboration has done that, we pool all our data together and then analyze it jointly. Okay, so Gabby already gave a really nice introduction to gravitational waves, so I won't really say, I just want to say a couple of words just to add to what Gabby mentioned. So there is the effect of a gravitational wave on a ring of particles as a plus polarized wave that is traveling in or out of the board. And as Gabby mentioned, there are two polarizations. This one is called the plus polarization and one that's rotated at 45 degrees, which is called the cross polarization. These are completely analogous to the polarizations in electromagnetism. So as you recall, in electromagnetism, one of the polarizations will move a test charge up and down, and the other one will move from side to side. In gravity, we need a ring of particles to show what the effect of a wave is, because gravity is a tensor force, and it acts in two directions at once, unlike electromagnetism, which is a vector force. Our strains, so the scale of our strains, is quite a bit bigger than the strains that Gabby has shown for LIGO. So we're looking at strains at about 10 to the minus 15 or so. But that's okay because the gravitational waves that we're looking for from our systems are also a lot bigger at these much lower frequencies. So why do we want to do this? We've already seen indirect evidence for gravitational waves from the Hulse-Taylor binary. There was a Nobel Prize for that. The big deal, or the real mission here, our job is to really build a telescope. This is both true for LIGO and pulsar timing. So I was happy to see this picture make the rounds. We put this together in NanoGrav back in March for reasons that you may guess. And we wanted to sort of show the wide range of experiments and sensitivities and different frequencies that are probed by the various gravitational wave experiments. And I wanted to make an analogy of this picture with what's going on in the electromagnetic spectrum. If you look at the frequencies that pulsar timing experiments probe, that's about 10 to the minus 8 hertz. And you go all the way to LIGO frequencies, which is at about 100 hertz or a kilohertz. That actually spans the entire EM spectrum, from radio to gamma rays. That span between 10 to the minus 8 hertz and about a kilohertz is the same span. And so clearly, it's important to study as much as possible of this gravitational wave spectrum, because different frequencies have different sources, and therefore different physics or different astrophysics that we can try to. Investigate. So our the most promising sources in the pulsar timing band are supermassive binary black holes. So the size and the composition of galaxies as we see them today is thought to arise from a hierarchical process where you have small galaxies early on in the universe that form that emerge to form slightly larger ones. Then these slightly larger ones emerge again, and so on, galaxies host supermassive black holes at their centers, and every time this merger happens, the black holes will meet and eventually merge and radiate gravitational waves. The kinds of waves that we are looking for, there's a cartoon on the top right here. I'll start from the bottom. This is something called a burst with memory, which happens right when the two black holes merge, right at the end of the process. Earlier on, when the black holes are further apart, they're orbiting each other in sort of a circular or quasi-circular orbit, they emit this a continuous sinusoidal wave. And then the superposition of all the bursts and all the continuous waves that all the black holes that ever merged in the history of the universe produce form a stochastic background, which is shown here at the top in red. And that's the strongest signal that we expect, is this stochastic background signal with possibly, we hope, and we should see as our sensitivity improves, continuous waves and bursts with memory that stick out of this background. Now, there are other sources as well, more exotic sources such as cosmic strings. Inflation also produces a signal in the band, though we hope it's buried deeply beneath our supermassive black hole background. phase transitions in the early universe. Okay, so how do we use pulsars to do this experiment? So pulsars are a type of neutron star. They have very strong magnetic fields. On the top right here, I show a cartoon. If the rotational axis runs vertically and the magnetic axis runs diagonally here, and there's radiation that is being produced by synchrotron radiation, so that you have basically beams of radio emission coming out of the magnetic poles. If this magnetic axis is aligned, crosses the line of sight between your phone and pulsar at any time in the rotation, we observe these systems as emitters of pulses of radio waves, and they're basically like off. And in particular, millisecond pulsars, so they're fast rotators, have periods of less than 20 milliseconds, they actually have an incredible timing stability, long-term timing stability, that we can exploit to try to detect gravitational waves. So for example, one of our best pulsars, 1713, a couple of weeks ago, had a rotational period given here, and then there's 15 zeros between the decimal point and the one here. And we can also, that was a couple of weeks ago, we can also make a prediction for how, you know, what the rotational period will be, you know, 5 years from now, about 5 years from now. And that's what the rotational period would be. Again, there's a 15 zeros between the decimal point and the one. So this extraordinary precision that we can, that we have in our ability to determine what the rotational period is what allows us to make a measurement of something that is sort of quite puny at the level of 10 to the minus 15. So here's a little animation of the effect of a gravitational wave on the Earth pulsar system. So here's our pulsar. Here's the Earth with a giant radio telescope on it. And as the gravitational wave is passing through the Earth pulsar system, it is changing the distance between the Earth and the pulsar, squeezing and stretching the train of pulses that is traveling from the pulsar to the Earth. So blue shifting as it is squeezing, and red shifting as it is stretching. Now this blue shifting and red shifting, of course, then result in an advance in the time of arrival of pulses relative to when we expected them to arrive, and a delay when the Earth is being stretched, the Earth pulsar system is being stretched out. Now it's not enough to have just one pulsar, because we can't rule out some astrophysical mechanism for some feature we observe in the times of arrival of our pulses. So what we want to do is have a collection of pulsars, and this is the concept of a pulsar timing array. So and in particular, what we want to look for is the correlated signal of a gravitational wave. If we have, you know, say some few tens of pulsars, the deviations in the times of arrival relative to what we expect are correlated among different pulsars. And in the case of the stochastic background, that correlation is shown in this figure here. This is called the Hellings and Downs curve. So what on the x-axis, we have the pulsar angular separation in degrees. So imagine you have two pulsars, okay, one over here, one over here. There's a certain angular separation that's shown on the x-axis here. And the y-axis shows the correlation in the deviation from the expected time of arrival from those two pulsars. So if the two pulsars are co-located, then it's normalized to a half, but they're basically perfectly correlated. And then as you move them apart, say around 90 degrees, they become somewhat anti-correlated. And then as you go out to 180 degrees, they become correlated again. So what we need to do to accomplish our goal is to observe an ensemble of pulsars and try to extract, in the case of the stochastic background, this correlated signal out of the noise. And you need many, many pulsars to do that. We use the two best radio telescopes in the world to perform our measurements, the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, which is the world's largest radio telescope, and also the Greenback Telescope in West Virginia, which is the world's largest steerable radio telescope. This guy here is 300 meters across. This guy here is 100 meters across, so it's about the size of a football field. And I wanted to mention also, perhaps people here in the audience are associated with this experiment, but as soon as the Canadian H1 mapping experiment, which is a radio telescope that's currently under construction, will actually contribute to nanograv timing. So what will happen there is that the CHIME will observe pulsars at low frequencies. Let me just explain for a couple of minutes why this is important. The interstellar medium produces effects in the times of arrival of the pulses that are frequency dependent because there's a dispersion in the interstellar medium. And so we need to do our measurements not just at a single frequency but at two frequencies to measure what the effects of dispersion are. And the nice thing about having CHIME is that in addition to measuring it at a somewhat lower frequency than we use with, say, the Green Band Telescope, there our measurements are about 800 megahertz. CHIME will do it at 400 megahertz, but it will actually free up time at our telescope so that we can then gain more sensitivity to gravitational waves that way. So here's what our data sets look like. Here's an example of what our data sets look like for three of our pulsars. What is shown on the x-axis of the time in years. On the y-axis is something called the residual. So we have a time of arrival of pulses that we measure, but then we subtract out a model from it. And what's left over is called the timing residual. And that's where we search for gravitational waves. This is the data set that we search for gravitational waves. The red is an old back end that we had called AST and GAST. And the blue is a new, much higher bandwidth back end called Guppy and Puppy, depending if it's a Green Bank or in Puerto Rico. And that increase in the bandwidth, it was more than a factor of 10 increase in the bandwidth. And so from there, you expect about a factor of 3 improvement in the residual, the square root of that factor. And so here we have some of those. In some cases, it's actually a bigger effect, and in some cases, actually a smaller effect than we observed. We observe 42 pulsars. Actually, this number may be a little bit out of date. It might be closer to 50 these days. At the GVT and Arecibo, and it's about every 3 weeks at two radio frequencies, as I mentioned. So what are our activities? So we're looking to improve the sensitivity of our experiment. We're looking for additional millisecond pulsars. And it turns out that the sensitivity basically scales linearly with the number of pulsars that you have. So having more pulsars is always better. And in certain cases, it's the best way to improve your sensitivity. We're also developing more efficient and sensitive pulsar searches and radio data. And a really important task that is taking up a lot of people's time in nanograv is actually detector characterization. So really understanding our pulsars and understanding our instruments well enough that we will believe a detection when we make it. Once we have a set of pulsars, we time them, we observe them with our radio telescopes. Our plans are to have regular 18-month data releases. We're also developing a new pulsar timing package. It turns out that everyone around the world is using basically the same pulsar timing package that was started development in the 70s, in the late 70s. And so we're developing alternatives to this. Again, for when the time of detection arrives, we want some robustness to a single package that is available. And of course, a cyber infrastructure or curation system. So here we build our instrument, here we create our data set, and then of course we perform searches for gravitational waves in our data set. And our goal is to, along with our data, our regular data releases, which will be made to the public every 18 months, give the scientific community and the public a comprehensive open source gravitational wave data analysis suite so that when we write a paper, we say we analyze it with this data that you can get over here and this code that you can also get in some other place. You run this and you will be able to reproduce our result. That is our goal. Okay, so where are we in terms of our sensitivity? So this plot shows the strain amplitude of the stochastic background as a function of time in years. The shaded region shows the expected amplitude range for the supermassive binary black hole background. The red curve, okay, let me just actually go in the order which I have in my slide. The top curve here is an upper limit that we set with a 5-year data set that we published just last year. We now have a 9-year data set, and this is our preliminary 2014 upper limit that we have. In red, we have our projections. These are very crude projections that we made using the 5-year data set, and you'll see that they're in very good agreement with the upper limit that we get. This is about a factor of 4 improvement in our upper limit, adding 4 additional years of data. So you can see that, well, first of all, we're already in astrophysically interesting territory. We're already setting upper limits in the regime where people expect to find a signal. And if there isn't a signal, we will continue pushing through and basically ruling out a large part of the viable parameter space in the next 5 years, basically. The green and the blue curve show what happens if there is a signal. So the green curve shows the amplitude that we detect in 50% of realizations of the universe. And the blue one shows the amplitude that we detect as a function of time in 90% of realizations of the universe. So you can see that in about 10 years, we'll have detected with 90% probability the entire range of expected amplitude. So once we make a detection, we'll be able to do some groundbreaking and unique, sort of different from what LIGO is doing, physics and astrophysics. So I've already talked about individual supermassive black holes as well as the collective signal that they produce. I mentioned cosmic strings in the early universe and high energy physics. The impacts on high energy physics that such a discovery would have would be, of course, outstanding and dramatic. Of course, whenever we gain enough sensitivity, there may be other things there that we had not predicted, that we had not expected to find. Okay, so I wanted now just to spend the remaining few minutes telling you about what we can say about alternative theories of gravity, and because I wanted to relate it to the physics and astrophysics of the Einstein Horizon Telescope. So there are two potential differences that arise in alternative theories of gravity. One is that you may have additional polarization states that will come up. So in general relativity, as Gabby mentioned and I mentioned, there's only two polarization states. And you can do there's a simple counting argument that you can use to get that number. You start with a metric perturbation, which is a 4x4 matrix that is symmetric, so that has 10 independent components. You can always do a coordinate transformation. So that takes 4 degrees of freedom out. In general relativity, it turns out you can also work in the Lorentz gauge, and that imposes an additional 4 conditions. And so that those 8 conditions total leave you to the 2 degrees of freedom. In general, though, in a metric theory of gravity, of course, you should always be able to do a general coordinate transformation. That should always be allowed. But you may or may not be able to work in the Lorentz gauge. And so that's where this number 6 comes from. In addition to the polarizations, gravitational waves could propagate with speeds that are smaller than the speed of light. For example, in massive gravity, where the graviton has a dispersion relation. So this is what the polarization states look like. Unfortunately, I don't have nice animations of this, but if somebody has made them or you know of them, I'd be very interested in acquiring it. And so these are the plus and the cross modes that I was talking about before. There is a breathing mode as well. So that acts on the ring of particles by basically making it bigger and making it smaller. There is a longitudinal mode, which acts along the direction of propagation of the gravitational wave. And these two are scalar modes of the graviton. And then there's also a couple of vector modes as well shown there. So this is what the antenna pattern looks like for these various modes. So this is kind of a little bit of a strange antenna pattern. The way we do it in the pulsar timing community is we fix the gravitational wave direction and then we move the pulsar around, which is not how LIGO does it, where you actually keep the detector fixed and then change the gravitational wave direction. But it's, of course, completely analogous. So here's the response of our detector to the plus and cross modes. Put the pulsar up here, basically in the opposite side to where the gravitational wave is coming from, you get less sensitivity. If you put it in the direction where the gravitational wave is, you get more sensitivity. And this is, this is the plus or cross, and you get the other one by rotating it 45 degrees. It's a tensor mode. These are the vector modes. Here I have fx. If you rotate it by 90 degrees, you get what the y looks like. And these are the two scalar modes, the reading mode antenna pattern and the longitudinal mode antenna pattern. So just very quickly, an example of how we might determine that other modes exist is to look at this expected shape of the correlation. So we have the plus and cross modes. We just have the usual Helling-Zeta-Downs curve. But if we have a breathing mode, then the correlation curve is going to change to what's shown here in the dashed line. So if we have enough breathing, if we have enough energy in the breathing mode, then our expected correlation will be modified, you know, some combination of these two, basically. So that's one thing that we could look for. I wanted to, I haven't really, the majority of the signal that we are sensitive to actually happens when the black holes are far away from each other, except for bursts with memory, which is actually the memory effect that results from a merger. And I was wondering, I'm curious to know if anybody has tried to look at bursts with memory in the context of alternative theories of gravity. You know, for example, the burst with memory basically is a discontinuity with a high frequency cutoff, which is the inverse of the light travel time of the final remnant black hole. And you know, for example, if you have some violation of cosmic censorship, well, then the black holes are maybe they're naked singularities. You would have them spinning around, emitting a lot more radiation. Is the burst with memory that you get bigger than that? I would expect that it would be, just because you have more time to emit gravitational waves. But I don't know what the answer to that is. And I think it would be good to know. In addition to, you know, what is the breathing mode or what is the longitudinal mode component of a burst with memory? So that's where we have a hope of seeing these things. So I think that's, and if anybody knows if this work has been done, I would be curious. And if it hasn't been done, I think it's kind of low-hanging fruit that somebody should do. Okay, so to conclude, pulsar timing experiments can be used to observe the low frequency, and by low frequency I mean 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 9 hertz, paint a picture of the universe at those frequencies. A detection is possible. I think it's actually even likely, if what we understand about astrophysics, the astrophysics is correct, it's actually likely that we'll make it within a decade. And as I ended saying, these experiments can be used to test gravity in a completely new way, in a dynamical, strong field way. Thank you.
John?
Regarding modified gravity, the scalar and vector modes can be screened away by screening mechanisms, which have published. So in that case, you wouldn't see any deviation from GR in the wave zone.
Right. So for example, if the graviton has a mass. Right. Well, actually, the graviton has a mass, I think, well, maybe this is naive, but I think all the gravitational waves are screened. I mean, even the plus and the cross modes will be screened. Right. So that could be a consequence. Yeah, I agree.
Yes.
So I guess just a comment on what John was asking. So the thing, the question was about the Weinstein mechanism, which basically what it does is that the scalar modes they don't couple at the small scales; they just couple on larger scales. So then it seems that in those cases you won't be able to, the coupling to a scalar mode goes to zero. And it would be hard to see them. So I think that's kind of generally the problem, that the modes that are, the theories that are interesting cosmologically have these screening mechanisms on a small scales. So they become, look like GR. So that's just a comment. So a question I have for you is measuring acceleration. Yeah, sorry.
Wait, can I ask you something about that?
Yeah.
What about production of these modes in an inflationary epoch? That's sort of a completely different.
Right. So of course, theories could be very different. But if theory of gravity is different back then you could do everything. But then what we're going to see today is an entirely different question. So if you have GR today, it doesn't propagate any scalar mode. So we're not going to see a scalar mode. Yeah. So question I have for you is, you didn't say anything about measuring acceleration, but I imagine that's one thing you could do as well by these pulsar, basically measuring the dipole in this diagram that you were showing, this Helling-Stahn diagram.
What do you mean, the dipole?
So by that I mean if the velocity is changing with time, the pulsar frequencies would be changing in a coherent way across the sky. Mm-hmm. And on one side they're going to be increasing, and the other side is going to be decreasing. If you just say Earth is accelerating around the center of the Milky Way, for example, or the solar system is. So is that something that's measured?
So measuring a dipole in the gravitational wave spectrum is certainly something that we know how to. We know how to do.
Right.
But it's the amplitude of that is going to be significantly weaker than the monopole, so that's something sort of for the future.
Right. Now I'm just thinking of ordinary things like acceleration of solar system around the center of the galaxy. That's just ordinary physics.
I'm not sure. Okay. I'm not sure. I can't answer that.
Thank you.
You mentioned the extra modes that you get, the extra propagating modes that you get in dynamical, you know, propagation of gravitational waves and anything like that in modified gravity theories. And of course, this is very important for gravitational waves, but it's irrelevant for the Event Horizon Telescope because we're looking for static spacetimes and all those degrees of freedom get radiated away. There are, however, modifications that could, in principle, have, you know, implications for the Event Horizon Telescope. For example, you know, parity violating theories. And those affect also propagation of gravitational waves because different polarization modes propagate at different speeds. Is there anything, and for the pulsar timing arrays, you're looking at propagations over enormous distances. Can you place constraints on such modifications that will make us, you know, forget about them with the EHT?
There are, as far as I know, the only constraints that I know of are projections, and therefore the mass of the graviton, basically, using pulsar timing experiments. But by the way, so I'm glad you brought that up because that's why I went on my little story about the burst of memory, because the connection with the Einstein Horizon Telescope is really at the level of things like cosmic censorship or black hair theorem. And so then the question is there anything is there a connection there that we could make? And the only one I can see is when the black holes are really close to coalescing. And then there will be a burst of memory there, and the question is, what is the burst of memory for the various theories that we might be able to detect? So that's exactly why I brought that up. But as far as I know, nobody has actually done any work on it.
Okay, so let us thank all the speakers.